Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present investigative journalist and author Greg Pallast, who examines what he believes to be the true mission of Donald Trump's Election Integrity Commission. Drew Spencer Penrose of the group Fair Vote, who talks about the importance of a case challenging partisan gerrymandering that will soon be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. And DACA recipient Eric Cruz Lopez and immigration attorney Joanne Lewis, who address key issues in the debate on the future of DACA at a recent hearing in New Haven, Connecticut. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Under growing criticism for the brutal ethnic cleansing targeting Myanmar's Muslim minority, the country's leader and Nobel Prize winner, Aung San Suu Kyi, canceled plans to go to the United Nations General Assembly meeting in New York City. Since late August, Suu Kyi has remained silent on the military offensive against the Muslim Rohingya minority, who have no citizen rights in Myanmar, a majority Buddhist nation. In response to the Rohingya insurgency's assault on several army posts, Myanmar's army attacked and burned Rohingya villages, forcing over 400,000 Rohingya to flee to Bangladesh. The UN Human Rights Commission has accused Myanmar of engaging in a textbook case of ethnic cleansing, and leaders of Muslim nations have accused Myanmar of committing acts of genocide. Responding to the violence, nearly 500,000 people signed a petition calling on the Nobel Prize Committee to strip Suu Kyi of her Peace Prize. Numerous Peace Prize winners, including Malala Yousafzai, Iranian lawyer Shirin Ebadi, and South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, have criticized Suu Kyi. Tutu, who won the 1984 Peace Prize for his opposition to the racist apartheid regime, declared, "If the political price for your ascension to the highest office in Myanmar is your silence, the price is surely too steep." Amid the ongoing debate over the future of the U.S. healthcare system, a new battle is brewing in the courts over drug prices. An important set of lawsuits targets one of the biggest reasons for high prices, the middlemen that manipulate the pharmaceutical supply chain by extracting profits at every turn. Eventually, the price gouging gets passed down to consumers. The middlemen, known as pharmacy benefit managers, administer drug benefits for health plans and claim to negotiate the lowest prescription drug prices directly with manufacturers and pharmacies. The lawsuit, however, charges that the PBMs are putting their own profits first and sticking consumers with the bill. A class action suit against CVS claims the pharmacy charged one plaintiff $165.68 for a generic drug that would have cost only $92 if she had paid out of pocket. Pharmacy benefits managers often impose a gag rule preventing pharmacists from discussing the true cost of drugs outside a given health plan. They may also require pharmacies to collect a copay, which in reality is a service charge paid to the benefit manager's company. Plaintiffs insist pharmacy chains have a fiduciary duty to inform consumers of the lowest possible price on prescription drugs. But pharmacy benefits companies have the power to deny consumers access to low-cost generic drugs. Critics of the pharmaceutical industry assert that real reform would consist of a national drug formulary with clear price information available to every American consumer. They say that until Congress acts, consumer advocates must rely on antitrust law and class action lawsuits to win prescription price transparency. The Commonwealth of Puerto Rico escaped the full brunt of Hurricane Irma as it tore through the Caribbean. Still, the island's antiquated electric grid collapsed during the storm, leaving 70% of the island's people without power. It was the culmination of years of neglect and disinvestment owing to Puerto Rico's extended debt crisis. The government-run Electric Power Authority declared bankruptcy in July and defaulted on $9 billion in bonds. Now, electric workers are resisting demands from wealthy bond investors to privatize the power utility. As Puerto Rico has suffered through a long recession over the last decades, over 500,000 residents have moved to the U.S. The island's government is now in an American court working to restructure $120 billion in debt nearly $35,000 of debt for each of the island's 3.5 million residents. In the face of Hurricane Irma, the Commonwealth did win an emergency declaration from the Trump administration for aid from both the National Guard and FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. All this as the island faces a direct hit from Maria, another Category 5 hurricane. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Not long after Donald Trump won the presidential election with the required Electoral College majority, he falsely claimed that he had lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton by some 3 million votes because millions of illegal votes were cast for the Democratic candidate. While Trump's accusation is baseless and has been repudiated by both Republican and Democratic state officials, the lie was a central rationale to justify an executive order establishing the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. The commission, chaired by Vice President Mike Pence, and whose vice chair is Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach, has been tasked with studying vulnerabilities in federal elections that can lead to fraudulent voter registrations and fraudulent voting. Critics of the commission point out that Kobach is well known as the architect of voter suppression laws adopted by states across the U.S., as well as Arizona's infamous anti-immigrant papers please law, SB 1070. In late June, Kobach requested voter information from all 50 state governments. However, the request for voters' names, addresses, birth dates, party affiliation, and the last four digits of Social Security numbers was refused outright by 19 states, with others unwilling to comply with key parts of the request. At a commission hearing held in Manchester, New Hampshire on September 12th, Chris Kobach was challenged for a column he had recently written for Breitbart News, asserting that there was proof of enough voter fraud in New Hampshire last November to possibly have influenced the outcome of a Senate race there. Your reporter spoke with investigative journalist Greg Palast, whose film documentary The Best Democracy Money Can Buy examines Kobach's role in employing his cross-check system that wrongly purged some 1.1 million Americans of color from the voter rolls in the 2016 election. Here, Palast examines what he believes to be the true mission of Donald Trump's Election Integrity Commission.
The mainstream press has decided that the Kobach Election Integrity Commission, Trump's special commission, it's all about Trump's ego because he wants to prove that he really won the popular vote. That is complete, can't say it on the air. It's not true. It is not about Trump's ego. It is about swiping the 2018 and 2020 elections. When Trump says 3 million people voted illegally, he's specifically citing, you have to go to the rest of his statement. Trump said people are voting many, many times. This goes back to the charge by his guy Kobach. It's not just a wacky claim. Oh, it's crazy. It's insane. No. It's worse than that. They actually have a list of 3 million people they claim have voted twice. And I'm the only journalist in the United States who actually bothered to get the list. 3.6 million pairs of names, they say, are double voters. It's actually 7 million people, Americans, who happened, I'll give you an example. Here's a good one. 583 guys named James Brown supposedly voted twice, once in Georgia and again in another state. Now, you can, and the only evidence that put him on this list is that the first name matches and the last name matches. So James Brown. And that meant that, and this is a real example, is James Thomas Brown, supposed to be the same guy as James Everett Brown. And James Brown Sr. is supposed to be the same guy as James Brown Jr. These are actual examples of this list. The middle names don't match. They don't care. Now, why would they do this? This is not about Trump's ego. in the last election, they actually removed 1.1 million people from the voter rolls. Names like Koch and Kobach and, frankly, Hemphill and Palast don't get on this list. It's names like Jose Garcia. It's names like James Brown. It's names like David Lee. Hispanic, Black, Asian American names. In other words, blue voters, Democratic voters, that is, minority voters. And that's because 85 of 100 names of the most common names in America are minority names. This is Jim Crow, but instead of white sheets to scare away voters of color, they're using spreadsheets.
And Greg, I wanted to ask, as you examine this so-called Election Integrity Commission, what is your understanding of its objective? Is it simply to provide a rationale for more voter suppression measures in Republican-controlled states, or is there a wider and maybe more dangerous objective that's part of this commission?
Chris Kobach said on Fox TV that he's going to try to take this system of naming double voters, which he calls cross-check, from 28 states, Republican states, to all 50 states by putting it in the national law, that you're going to have to purge your voter rolls of double voters. And he's going to give you the list, which is why he asked all 50 states, by the way, to provide him the voter list. And for your information, most of those states that said that they would never turn over to Chris Kobach and this commission their voter rolls did turn over their voter rolls. So what's happening here is that they want to take this system and make it nationwide. They also have a second thing that they want to do. He's made it very clear, Kobach. He's not hiding it. He wants to prove that there are a million illegal aliens who voted in the last election as well. Basically, Mexicans who crossed the border to vote for Hillary, you know. So this canard of the alien voters, and what he wants to do, he's taking the Homeland Security lists of deportees. So you're going to, once again, you're going to get names like Jose Hernandez. They're going to say, oh, my gosh. There's a Jose Hernandez who was deported, but there's a Jose Hernandez on the voter rolls of Arizona. And so they have to be removed, the illegal aliens. If they're really removing illegal aliens, why would we wouldn't object? But they're not. What they're doing is they're taking common Latino names. And so you find them on the deportation list, and then they're knocking off American voters with similar names.
That was investigative reporter and author Greg Palast, whose film documentary is titled The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, The Case of the Stolen Election. Find links to Palast's investigation and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. While Donald Trump emerged as a victor in the 2016 presidential election by winning the majority of Electoral College delegates, he lost the popular vote to his Democratic opponent, Hillary Clinton, by nearly 3 million ballots. One of the critical states in determining Trump's narrow victory was Wisconsin, which he won by less than 1% of votes cast. Yet Trump led Clinton in 63 of the state's 99 assembly districts and 23 of Wisconsin's 33 state Senate districts. The votes of Wisconsin Democrats are less powerful than that of Republicans because of the way in which legislative maps are drawn, where Democratic voters are packed into fewer districts. That produces results where the GOP, whatever its share of the vote in statewide races for president or governor, are likely to win a much higher share of legislative seats. The drawing of legislative district maps to provide an advantage to one party over another is known as partisan gerrymandering. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments in an important case known as Gill v. Whitford this October that challenges partisan gerrymandering. The case reached the Supreme Court after Wisconsin's Republican Governor Scott Walker appealed a November 2016 three-judge federal panel ruling that ordered Wisconsin's legislature to redraw the state assembly map due to what it found to be unconstitutional partisan gerrymandering. Your reporter spoke with Drew Spencer Penrose, legal and policy director with the group Fair Vote. Here, Penrose talks about the importance of this case and possible remedies to prevent partisan manipulation of legislative district maps.
So what partisan gerrymandering is, in this particular case, is when one political party draws district lines in a way to maximize the number of seats they'll get and minimize the number of seats that an opponent party will get. And in Wisconsin, it's Republicans. It actually has been more Republicans than Democrats, mostly because Republicans control more state legislatures than Democrats. But it's not just a Republican problem. In fact, a very similar case is coming out of Maryland, where Democrats pretty openly gerrymandered the state in favor of Democratic candidates. The way that they do it really goes to the heart of the case, and that is that if you can take a district and draw it around a lot of Democratic voters, really pack in the Democratic voters, then the Democratic candidate in that district will win with like 70 or 80% of the vote. And basically that means that a lot of the votes were wasted on a candidate who was going to win anyway. And then the other thing you can do is draw districts so that the Democratic candidates can't possibly win. So if Democrats are 40% of the district, then those votes are all essentially wasted as well, because they can't help elect a candidate. And so if you measure these wasted votes and say, are there more wasted votes for Democrats than there are for Republicans, then that means that Republicans' votes are more efficient. They're actually more powerful than Democratic votes. And that's really what partisan gerrymandering is in this case, is where you strategically draw these districts in order to make one group of voters' votes powerful and another group of voters make their votes very not powerful. And this case is arguing that that is unconstitutional. It's not the first time that people have tried to make this case. However, it's been really very difficult to get courts to buy into any particular theory of how you determine when this has happened and when it hasn't, because it's something that can happen just sort of naturally. The people drawing the district lines will be trying to group communities of interest and that sort of thing. And the system isn't really designed to create a fair representation. It's a winner-take-all system, and so sometimes that creates disparities on its own, and courts have been really hesitant to jump in and try to adjudicate these, but this one's really different. It's a really extreme case of partisan gerrymandering, a really clear case, and what they have that's different from prior cases is that they have developed a test, a very simple mathematical test for how you determine if a state is really very badly lopsided. And that's what Justice Kennedy has asked for before in prior cases where theories like this have failed, is he's asked for a clear test, and this time they have one, so it's a really interesting time. In this case, if the four justices who are now in the court who are considered liberal vote the same way as the four then, which I think most people expect that they will, and Justice Kennedy is convinced, then that will be a 5-justice majority, and that'll be the first case to strike down a partisan gerrymander.
Drew, explain to our audience some of the methods that you and your organization favor for determining district maps across the country, state by state, that won't skew the electorate in a way that, you know, gives one party or the other party a partisan advantage.
So I was talking about wasted votes earlier. Like, that's how gerrymandering is done, is by manipulating wasted votes. The method that we think is really the best for the United States is called ranked choice voting. If you apply ranked choice voting to a 5-winner election, then the number of wasted votes necessarily goes down almost to zero. So, of course, the number of wasted votes will be the same between the Democrats and the Republicans, because it'll be zero, right? If there are no wasted votes, then there's no disparity in wasted votes. We've had a proposal that we call the Fair Representation Act. This is a model proposal for electing Congress in multi-winner districts with ranked choice voting. This year in June, Representative Don Beyer from Virginia actually introduced it as a bill. So there's a bill in Congress right now, H.R. 3057, that would elect all of Congress from multi-winner districts with ranked choice voting. That would effectively end gerrymandering for all of Congress.
That was Drew Spencer Penrose, legal and policy director with the group Fair Vote. Find more commentary and analysis on the issue of partisan gerrymandering by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On September 11th, U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut sponsored an emergency field hearing on immigration issues at the same New Haven church where Marco Antonio Reyes had taken sanctuary for more than 6 weeks since he received a deportation order to his native Ecuador. Blumenthal said such hearings can't be held in Washington, D.C., under the Republican congressional leadership, but he hoped to take the stories he heard back to Congress to bolster the effort to pass the DREAM Act that would allow undocumented youth to work or attend school in the U.S. and put them on a path to citizenship. Before the hearing, President Trump had rescinded Barack Obama's executive order known as DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, that would take effect in 6 months, declaring that Congress can use that time to pass legislation allowing these undocumented young people to remain in the U.S. Individuals facing deportation and their family members spoke at the hearing, representing many countries including South Korea, Canada, Mexico, Brazil, Albania, and Ecuador. Others, including a U.S.-born citizen who was the son of immigrants, spoke and said that an attack on any of them is an attack on him. Three immigration lawyers also addressed the hearing, describing some of the challenges undocumented immigrants face. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the hearing and brings us excerpts from two of the speakers. We hear first from Eric Cruz Lopez, a community organizer and programming coordinator with the group Connecticut Students for a Dream. He spoke against the common representation of dreamers as being brought illegally to the U.S. through no fault of their own.
I work day in and day out for undocumented students such as myself, because I am undocumented, and I came to this country when I was 7 years old. And when I say I came to this country, I mean that very intentionally, because we need to end the narrative that we were brought here to this country through no fault of our own, because we, together with our families, made the difficult, the very, very difficult decision to come to this country together. And I know the majority of us, had we been of age to make a conjunct decision with our parents, we would have all decided to come here together, right? Because I will not stand here and let my families be blamed and let my parent and my mother be blamed for the decision to come to this country. If they go down, I'll go down with them. I don't believe I will rise above my own conditions if my parents do not come up with me, if the rest of my community doesn't come up with me. I will not work for bills that offer comprehensive immigration reform if they will further criminalize my communities and the communities that live along the border. With that being said, I do have DACA for the moment, and DACA did change a lot of what I could do. I remember when I was in high school, when DACA had just come out, I had been offered an internship for this really good program, right? Because I was a really good student. And I had to say no. I had to say no, I can't. I'm undocumented and I can't take this internship. And that week we had submitted in our paperwork for DACA. And all we had to do was wait. Eventually, I got my DACA approved, right? It was awesome, it was a great day. But the first thing I did was that I went back to school, I went to the principal's office, and I said, can I take that internship, right? Like, I can work legally now, can I take that internship? And they said yes. They were like, yes, we'll make that happen as soon as we can, right? Like, we wanna make sure that you have that opportunity that you are more than qualified to take. And I took that internship, and that internship opened a lot of doors. That internship allowed me to get a full scholarship to the University of Connecticut, where I'm now studying to be a high school math teacher. A dream that if DACA ends, if I'm not given a pathway to work, will not be accomplished, right? And so I want to ask everybody in this room that you fight not just for me, right? Because I am a high achieving student. I did graduate a valedictorian. I did go to university on a full scholarship. But I want you to also fight for those who do not fit that mold, because I also am outside the mold, right? There are also a lot of things about me that you do not know right now, that if those were the only things you knew about me, you would decide to not give me a pathway to citizenship, you would decide to not give me a work permit. I want everybody in this room to agree to fight for everybody in my community, for the high achievers, but also for the high school dropouts, for the people who've made a mistake and also for the people who are parents, workers, nurses, and teachers. So if I can get a verbal commitment, a loud yes, that you will fight for more than just myself, that would make me very happy. So thank you, everybody.
Another speaker was immigration attorney Joanne Lewis.
The DACA, when it was proposed, was done as a stopgap in the hope that the DREAM Act would be passed in the 2 years. But instead, we've had to renew cases and renew cases. I'd like to stray a little bit from DACA and just mention two other things that I see in today's climate about immigration. Many of my clients are domestic violence victims, people that I can do something for the most part. But many of them are afraid now. They're afraid to call the police. They're afraid to go down to the police station to get their fingerprints taken so that I can verify that they have no record when I file their applications. The third thing that I want to mention is I also represent some of the children who've come up recently from Central America, from countries where there are horrible conditions, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. And those children are in a detention center, nice detention center, it's a shelter in Mystic, Connecticut, but they're having trouble finding sponsors for them, sponsors being family members, generally. And the family members, if they're undocumented, are themselves afraid to take in a child because some of them are being picked up when they come to get the children. That hasn't happened in Connecticut yet, but it's happened in other states. So there are children who are basically in these shelters who may have a way to stay in the United States if they were settled and in a place that somebody could represent them. So these are my frustrations right now. And if we can do nothing else, at least hopefully we can pass the DREAM Act. Thank you.
That was immigration rights attorney Joanne Lewis, preceded by DACA recipient Eric Cruz Lopez, speaking at an immigration hearing held by U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut at a church in New Haven. For more perspectives on DACA and the debate on U.S. immigration policy, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, WGRN in Columbus, Ohio, FRSC in Santa Cruz, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.